What is the most important e-discovery issue today?
Cost control?
Technology-assisted review?
Information management?
Preservation?
From the latest cases to the newest technologies.
Our goal is to expose legal professionals to the most important e-discovery trends
with the brightest e-discovery experts.
Rulemaking,
predictive coding,
litigation hold,
proportionality,
document review,
social media,
efficiency,
ethics,
cooperation. Welcome to the ESI Report, sponsored by Kroll On Track, an e-discovery software and service provider. You are listening to the Legal Talk Network.
Hi, I'm Michelle Lang, and welcome to the ESI Report. It may soon be time to buy or download a new copy of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Today, we will be discussing the current proposed FRCP amendments and what effect they may have on e-discovery. Here to help, we have the honor of welcoming the federal and state rules guru, Tom Allman. Tom is an adjunct professor at the University of Cincinnati College of Law, the former senior VP and general counsel of a very large corporation, chair emeritus of Working Group 1 of the Sedona Conference, and former chair of the e-discovery committee of Lawyers for Civil Justice. In addition, Tom helped initiate the movement for the 2006 amendments to the FRCP and recently has been attending the committee hearings for the current rule proposals. Specifically, we will be discussing the current key amendments that have been opened to public comment by the Rule Standing Committee. Tom, thanks for joining me today.
You're most welcome, Michelle. And Michelle, will our listeners be able to access the actual text of the proposals?
They will. I believe we have them loaded on theediscoveryblog.com.
Okay, then I will be assuming in my answers that people are able to turn to it and get the actual text.
I think that's a fair assumption. Why don't we get started by talking a little bit about the push for the new amendments, where we are in the process? I know you've had your finger on the pulse of all these developments. So why don't you give a little bit of a status check for our listeners?
Thanks, Michelle. As Michelle implied, around a decade ago, a number of us pushed for amendments to the federal rules to recognize the unique aspects of electronic information as compared to what most of us were then most familiar with, which was hard copy. By the time the amendments were passed and became effective at the end of 2006, of course, we also had a robust body of case law that had already contemplated that ESI would be treated the same as documents. Most of what happened in 2006 was fairly modest. Probably the most important thing was that the rules expressly recognized that electronically stored information, and I'm just going to call it ESI from now on, that ESI had to be treated under the discovery rules. And so the unique aspects of the rules were primarily with the early discussion requirements of problems such as the form or forms in which production would take place. And then, of course, the unusual addition of a restraint on the right of judges to sanction the routine good faith loss of information, something that I pioneered in as early as 2000 on the grounds, which I thought were reasonable at the time, that we should reassure folks that if they acted in good faith, they would not be sanctioned. By 2010, some 4 to 5 years later, it had become apparent to many of us that this was not the case, that the courts had really kind of bought into the argument in the Second Circuit that mere negligence, that is to say, the mere failure to follow a reservation standard established in one of the lower courts, was sufficient to justify harsh sanctions, including instructions to juries that they could deem people to be spoliators and that people would be sanctioned by adverse inferences drawn from the missing evidence. This led at the time of 2010 to a panel on which I sat with Judge Shindlin and several others. Our panel recommended that the rules should be amended to provide bright lines, things that people could do so they would know that they would be in compliance with the rules and thus avoid sanctions. And we thought about ideas of spelling out trigger and also the scope of the duty to preserve, and then tying the sanction provisions directly into the level of intent and the culpability standards that would be required for each one. To make a long story short, by the time that Duke conference was over, 2 days of conferences, a number of other ideas had floated to the surface, and it is those combination of ideas in general and the Rule 37 problem in particular that have led to where we are today, and that is as follows. Today, here in the summer of 2013, we face a package of amendments that have been approved by the Rules Committee and its supervisory group, the Standing Committee, for public comment this summer. In other words, coming to your email account and to your company's inbox in the near future will be a package of rules, starting with Rule 1 and running up through Rule 37, that really grew out of this 2010 conference and the discontents that were exhibited there.
That's great. That's great. Could you maybe give listeners a little bit more of a high level overview of the rules that are potentially at play here to be amended? I know that it's a pretty exhaustive and comprehensive list, but maybe just hit some of the high points.
I wouldn't even call it exhaustive or comprehensive. I would call it eclectic. It's a collection of the biggest gripes. And let me just start with Rule 1. Rule 1 is to be amended in such a manner so that parties will be encouraged to cooperate. This was a big theme at the Duke Conference. It's a relatively minor amendment to the rule, but the term cooperation will be inserted into the draft note. And there very well may be consequences of that. The second and probably the most dramatic change from the standpoint of the rules themselves is that Rule 26B1, which defines the scope of discovery and which has been tinkered with now for some time, will be changed so that the clause will be shortened and the standards for proportionality dealing with when a court should exercise its restraints will be inserted right up there in the scope of discovery. This will be a very controversial proposal for those folks who are convinced that the trend is to try to restrict discovery. Those folks who are a little bit more sanguine about it will simply say to themselves, well, this is merely moving the proportionality principle from where it was buried in Rule 26C up into Rule 26B. And then, of course, the dramatic change that I alluded to earlier is that because parties have given up more or less on the Safe Harbor Amendment of 37E in the 2006 rules, there is a whole new approach to it that is going to receive the same label. It'll also be 37E, but it'll change dramatically how this will be applied, and it will primarily go directly at the question of the culpability that is required to impose harsh sanctions, such as preclusive or adverse inference sanctions. And it will also bring into the rules for the first time the concept of prejudice, requiring a showing of substantial prejudice before those same kinds of sanctions can be employed. There are other eclectic changes in there, the number of hours permitted for depositions, the number of requests for admissions, etc. Some of those things have been changed or tinkered with. There are also some very important but probably obvious changes to the Rule 16 and Rule 26F conferences to emphasize the importance of dealing with evidence Rule 502. And also to deal with some of the timing issues with an attempt to force judges to issue scheduling orders a little more quicker than in the past, what many of the folks at the Duke Conference called case management. They are They are attempts to tinker with case management and make it more responsive.
So, Tom, maybe you can talk a little bit more about the controversy around 37E and you know, where are the arguments coming from, and where do you think it's headed?
Right now, there is a real split in the case law as to what is the required showing of culpability to impose severe sanctions that lead to people being spoliated or labeled as spoliators. Many in the corporate community who are the ones who are over-preserving, that is to say, who are gambling that they have no choice but to adhere to the most extreme standards. Many in the corporate community believe that a fairer way of doing things would be to have a single uniform culpability standard that applies across the United States so that no matter where you're going to get sued or where you sue somebody, the same standards apply. That is the underlying cause of the discontent that has led the Discovery Subcommittee, chaired by now District Judge Grimm, to require, as Rule 37 will read, and let me just read it to you here, Rule 37E will now state that a court may not impose any sanction which is listed in Rule 37B, or give an adverse inference jury instruction unless the court finds that the party's actions have, quote, caused substantial prejudice in the litigation and were willful or in bad faith, close quote. So that is a different approach than was taken in the existing Rule 37E, and the hope is that by making it a uniform approach across the country, it will basically do away with the case law that says that the mere finding of negligence, that is to say the failure to observe a standard, is sufficient to justify those sanctions or those adverse inferences. I do not yet know, because frankly it hasn't been open for public comment yet, I do not yet know if there will be an outcry from the usual suspects that this is an attempt to somehow allow the corporate world to get away with deliberate destruction of information that's needed for discovery. I hope that does not happen. After all, the majority of the circuits have this rule already. This actually represents by far, in terms of the quantity of courts, the largest choice of ways to deal with this. However, it flies in the face and is a repudiation of Zubilek. It's a repudiation of pension committee. It is a repudiation of residential funding. And in fact, it's candidly stated in the current draft notes and minutes that this is intended to repudiate cases that permit a finding of severe sanctions based upon negligence and gross negligence. If there is a fight over that, I am reluctant to predict the outcome, except to say that it would be a shame if that lesser standard were to be adhered to across the country, and it'd even be worse if the courts, in interpreting this new rule, were to find that the local circuit standards would be applied rather than the uniform rule. I have spent a lot of time thinking about how best to make sure that does not happen. And I think that as in this present form, I think there's some tinkering that's going to have to be done to make it clear that when we talk about willful or bad faith conduct, we are really talking about a level of culpability that implies a specific intent to knowingly fail to meet an obligation, not merely failing to meet somebody else's obligation, such as pension committee establishes. But this is going to require some real careful thought, and it's going to be very interesting to see what others who are not as close to us as I've been feel when they see this language.
So, Tom, related to that, with regards to all of the rule proposals, what would you consider are the most important implications if these amendments go through as currently drafted, that practitioners should know about?
The problem with any rule, of course, is that when all is said and done, each case is tried individually, and courts are going to look at the facts of every specific case. I do not regard any of these changes that I've just alluded to as requiring any change in the current good faith conduct of parties. More to the point, however, it at least opens up the possibility for, again, I have to speak from my background, which is as a general counsel, it opens up the possibility that folks who currently err on the side of overpreservation because they're afraid they will be treated unfairly. It at least opens up the possibility that as courts affirm around the country that they're going to be bound by this rule and as interpretations come out about it, it leaves open the possibility that proportionality will take on a real life of its own in the case of preservation as well as production, and that folks who make a good faith effort to carry out proportional steps, both in preservation and production, will find courts amenable to it. I regard this as intimately related to the movement of local protocols, guidelines, and local rules that are trying to accomplish that same task. And so I see this as a very positive development. As far as the what I called earlier the case management changes, I do not regard any of them as being something that will change conduct. But my hope is that both the courts and the parties will take advantage of them where they're applicable, and perhaps a good example would be the Rule 502 agreements. I mean, there's really no reason why parties should not and courts should not routinely enter 502 agreements, and to the extent that those kinds of agreements get entered earlier and more often and with a little bit more clarity, I think there is at least the possibility of addressing the hidden issue that's lurking behind all of this, which is the excessive costs that come about as electronic discovery makes its way into the fold. I neglected to mention earlier that one of the other tinkering amendments that's being proposed is that Rule 26C will now expressly refer to the allocation of expenses as within the power of a judge who is asked to take into account such things as a lack of proportionality in both preservation and production. Some of us wanted it to be a little bit more explicit, but it's pretty good the way it is in the rule right now.
So, Tom, before we wrap it up here, like you mentioned, the full text of the rule proposal package is available on the ediscoveryblog.com on that website under a blog post from June 11th, 2013, entitled Rulemaking Efforts Move Forward. So folks that are listening to this podcast can navigate to that blog and take a look at the full package of the rule amendment proposals. So Tom, before we wrap it, just one last question on how long is this process going to take?
We're looking at least another 2 years and maybe even three, depending on whether or not the committee decides that they need to revise some of their package after public comment and whether or not the standing committee immediately buys off on it or sends it back for further views. And, of course, it's important to remember that no matter what the rules committee do, the Supreme Court gets a crack at it. They've been known to make changes or even to stop the process. And then, of course, Congress has a six-month period in which they, too, can either change or stop the process. So we're a long, long, long way from getting it done. But I must say, back in 2000, 2002, when we first talked about the 2006 amendments, I remember having the same conversation with others and saying to myself, well, gee, this isn't going to make any difference. It's never going to happen. Well, it did happen, and it will happen here. And so it's time to get on board now and to make your views well known.
Well, with that, thank you, Tom. Thank you for your expertise in explaining the new package of rule amendment proposals. It was interesting and very informative. And with that, we're ready to wrap this month's ESI report. Thank you again to Tom Allman for bringing his expertise to the show, And finally, thank you to everyone for listening. This was another podcast sponsored by Kroll OnTrack. For all discussions of e-discovery, don't hesitate to log on to theediscoveryblog.com. And if you're on Twitter, follow me at Michelle C.S. Lang. Until next time, I'm Michelle Lang, signing off for the ESI Report.
This was another edition of the ESI Report, sponsored by Kroll OnTrack. Be sure to follow Kroll OnTrack on Facebook and Twitter, or learn more about Kroll OnTrack software and services at www.krolontrack.com. Thanks for listening to the ESI Report, produced by the broadcast professionals at Legal Talk Network. Join Michelle Lang for our next podcast on the latest e-discovery trends. Subscribe to the RSS feed on LegalTalkNetwork.com or in iTunes. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, Legal Talk Network, its officers, directors, employees, agents, representatives, shareholders, and subsidiaries. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer.